Ladies and gentlemen,
lend me your ear. Hi, this is your host Q, live and direct from Psyche Studio, Kochi. Welcome to The Groundbreaking, where we sit down with creators, design and business pioneers to discuss their journeys, process and approach. Feels good to be back after a few weeks of hiatus, and we're gonna go strong from here. Excited to say that we have shifted our bases to the God's own country, Kerala. We are working on something special and really excited to share with you moving forward. If you're listening to this podcast for the first time, consider subscribing. If you're listening to it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, give us ratings. It helps us to reach to bigger audience, and also because we are doing one episode a week. As always, we value the feedback, so please reach out to us with any comments or questions you may have. You can also shoot me a mail mentioned in the podcast description. For this episode, we have Vyasateja Rao, founder of Analogy Design, a product design and innovation studio based in Bangalore, India. He shares his fascinating journey of learning design in the United States and then returning to India to establish a successful design business. Throughout our conversation, we delve into the changing landscape of design in India and explore the exciting opportunities for design education to improve in the country. We've also delved into the valuable insights about world of design and innovation and discover how he's making his mark in the rapidly evolving field. Hello, Vyasa. How's it going with you?
Hey, Deepak. It has been quite a long time. I know we've been dodging meetings and calls between work schedules, but finally, I'm very glad. I'm very glad we took this time to talk. And it's a pleasure to be on your podcast, man.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, likewise, it's been some time that we've been in touch, I'm already very excited to, you know, what we're going to talk about. Very, very excited. What's happening, Vyasa? Tell us where you are. Are you at your office or you're at home? What's happening?
Yeah, definitely very much at the studio. I can say it's kind of like a mix of, good and better right now. So obviously we're expanding and we're doing a lot of things in the experiential design space, right? So a few of those things are materializing. We had a lot of plans for the last 6 months on where we want to move, what markets we want to look into, what are the kind of people we want to bring on board. So we're actively hiring, and that is another, I'm sure you know, that's a daunting task of going through and picking the right people, not trying to break up the existing team dynamics by bringing somebody very different on board. Right. So, that's basically what's happening. And we're trying to be kind of like cognizant of the fact that, you know, there's client work, but at the same time, you're trying to design or kind of look for how to scale. And then also trying to make decisions on what is the right approach to scale. Right. So we're just in the midst of all of that. And so that's basically what's going on right now.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a lot, Vyasa. And I think I've been seeing a lot of stuff from you as well. I think your speaking engagement at Mumbai Design Express. And I think your studio also recently got IF Award, if I'm not wrong.
Yep.
So yeah, congrats for that. I mean, that's definitely inspiring as well. I mean, I've been seeing whatever you've been putting out very closely. Let's take a deep dive in your journey. I mean, where have you started? I mean, I think you've studied design to start with. You always wanted to be a designer or something.
Yeah, so I did study industrial design, but the funny thing is, until I was 26, I had no clue that there was a very specialized, discipline called industrial design. I've always known what I wanted to do, but I never knew there was a formal training for it, there was an education or a degree for it, right? So obviously, I had the aspirational goal of being an Air Force pilot, so that was my initial thing. And I tried my best, and obviously my physique is not one where I could actually cross and become a pilot. Second thing being, the disadvantage of being the only kid to your parents is even more detrimental, because they were absolutely against my concept of being an Air Force pilot. So that kind of ended at that. And I said the closest thing I'll try to do is mechanical engineering, because in my mind, in my naive mind at that point of time, mechanical engineers are the ones who work on aircrafts, right? So at least if I can fly one, I'll be close to one, I can see it every day. But that also didn't happen because I was, again, very naive that, you have aeronautical engineering, you have a lot of different specialized branches. And then finally, after I started working at the General Motors Technical Center in India and Bangalore, that's when I was really exposed to industrial designers. There was a styling team, and I got a lot of help from Mr. Satyasilan, who's now the assistant general manager, I think, of design for Ashok Leyland. So I consider him my first mentor in design. So he mentored me very closely. I mean, like I told you, almost on a personal level. I used to go to his house in Whitefield. It was a long bike ride, but it was not as bad. Bangalore was not as bad as far as traffic was concerned at that point of time. So I used to be there. He taught me how to sketch. He taught me how to think like a designer. And I put up my first portfolio, and I applied to a bunch of universities in the US. One of the things that he very, and I'm very happy for that feedback that he gave me, and it was a very turning point in my life. So that's the reason why even today when he calls, no matter where I am, I pick up the phone. Because that piece of advice changed my career forever. And he was like, I think he did a little bit of profile research on me, like how I was, the kind of things I do, my existing soft skills and everything that he knew, right? Like he said, like, no, you're not good here. I think you should move to the US and I think you should study that. So I did a little bit of research and I applied to a bunch of schools, CCS, DAP in Cincinnati, I think CCA as well, and North Carolina State and the usual public universities as well. I got through and I studied industrial design at the North Carolina State University School of Design. So, it's not that I knew from day one that I would be a designer. I kind of wanted to be a designer, but I never was able to frame it in a way that, oh, you know, this is what industrial design is and this is what I wanted to work on. Only once I practically saw it happen with, being amongst the teams there, the sketches they were doing, the posts on the wall, and then, you know, the critiques that were happening, right? Like all of these things were, then I realized that I was good at it. I could actually relate to it. And I didn't mind working, 12, 14 hours a day on this stuff because I really didn't consider it work at work as well. I had this, insatiable curiosity of what is next? What can I do next? What can I do next? So I kind of realized that this is what I wanted to do. And from then onwards, I just went to study and NC State was great. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I think if I'm not wrong, you mentioned that you're coming from a family of creative.
Yeah,
so I'm damn sure that you had some idea about, what this field looks like.
Yeah, definitely. I think so. I have a very rich background in my family side from art. Like my aunt is a Ganjifa National Award winner, or rather she was one of those. Like she just recently passed away during COVID. So, she used to do these Ganjifa paintings and she was well recognized for it. My grandfather on my father's side, like, so he was one of the court painters in the Mysore Maharajas. So, and then a lot of my other family members are, my uncle used to build engines for Java. So my family had a lot of that, tinkering, creativity, art sort of a background. And I was exposed to it from a very young age. So I used to spend a lot of time with my uncle, the one I was telling you about, the Java engines. I still do today. And he was very entrepreneurial. So he would show me the parts of the bike. They were even building some very interesting bikes for the Czechoslovakian police at that time. And there were these massive, huge ones with red and blue lights and all that. And I got to see a lot of that. And that really, inspired me in terms of like building and creating. And I've always wanted to do that. And whenever I had time, I would build like paper models, obviously at that time it was bikes and aircraft and planes and that sort of stuff. And that was always very inspiring. My mom also does a lot of Rangoli stuff. My dad built houses. So in a way, I didn't realize it at that point of time, but now when I look back on it and in hindsight, it's always been very influential in terms of like an entrepreneurial journey, or let's say even creating and building things. My family's always been doing that for quite a while. That I think was, it was a pretty profound impact that I had in terms of growing up. I was always around these kinds of activities in the family. So that really helped me in terms of confidence later in my career, saying that, you know, I can do this sort of stuff because I know my father's done it, my uncle did it, my aunt's done it, and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's been very interesting in terms of, you know, what kind of skill sets my family members had, because it's kind of like, you know, invisible to you. You look at it from the outside and you see like, oh, have you seen that guy's family? I mean, he's got this. But when it's in your own family, you just kind of, you know, like, oh, my uncle used to do this. But now, hindsight, when you look at it, it's very interesting. Yeah.
So I think constantly reflecting on things is also something which is very important, you know. I think it knowingly, unknowingly, it has always been there.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I mean, I'm glad to know. I guess we see from your journey that you've studied in US. I mean, that too at a really, you know, good place. And you worked in US for some time. What brings you back to India? I'm sure you could have had like an amazing career in US. So was it like, starting your own thing, or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was pretty happy in the US. I mean, like the things that I was working on, they were very interesting. Some of the companies I worked at, I learned a ton of stuff. I mean, again, like you said, you know, reflecting on things, and that's a very good thing. That's helped me quite a lot in my career. Like even today, if you look at it, that's a habit that I have every single day. I kind of look back at the day. What did I do right? What did I not do right? There are some, you know, things I would correct, I would actually fix. So that I've been doing for a very long time. I've always been that kind of a person who kind of reflects on what, and then I kind of think of, like, okay, if I were to do this again, what would I do better? So in that way, like when I look at the US, it gave me a lot of things. I mean, to be very honest with you, I never knew how to manage money on my own, right? Like I was a single child and my parents gave me what I wanted. So in that way, you know, the very first time when I went to the US is when I started figuring out how to budget for, like, you know, living on my own and things like that. But when I started looking at design very closely and what I was doing, I kind of felt I hit a kind of like a stagnant period of doing things. So even if I had moved on to another job, yeah, I would have got a very good pay hike. I would have probably made a lot more money. But from a satisfaction point of view of what I was doing, I kind of was lacking. And it affected my design work to a very great extent. Like, I mean, I remember my CEO telling me in one of my companies saying that, you know, your design's getting really bad, dude. Like, I mean, I think you should take a break or you should move to engineering. And he did move me to engineering. And that again was one of the best things that's ever happened to me, because when I was in engineering, I just worked on engineering projects. Because I have a dual background as a mechanical engineer, I could do that. But that gave me a break that was so good. It kind of refreshed whatever I had lost as a designer, right? And as designers, we have a lot of baggage that we carry also, right? We have the pressure of being the best. We always constantly compare ourselves to somebody else. We compare what we're doing in a job to somebody else, right? And we always aspire to be somebody else at all points of time. We never look at what we are doing well also. So that was happening with me very, very much. But then after a period of time, I mean, after a very long period of time, my last job was at Solaris as a very senior executive. And I was working with the founders hand in hand. I was kind of leading all the product efforts. I redid their branding. We were taking a full new approach in packaging. It was exciting work. And we were doing new retail stores. I was doing store design. It was all exciting stuff. But there was somewhere in the middle I was missing what I used to do core, like which is building products, right? Like, and at that time, just connected products were just starting out. This is like 2012, 2013. And I kind of felt there was a need for a design practice that kind of focused on both, right? It takes time to kind of, and UX was nowhere in the picture at that point of time. It was still interaction design. It was a little bit of here and there. There was never this sort of a boom that had happened. And I kind of figured that it would be very interesting if I explored and experimented on combining both physical and digital realms and kind of come up with a new process and a new experience to deal with it. But there were a lot of logistical challenges of making it work in the US because I was not a citizen. There are a lot of challenges in terms of setting up something. The capital is extremely high, right? Like where you need a lot of money, so I would have to get funding and things like that, which was not going to be a problem. But again, I was thinking of, would I be comfortable focusing on these things, or would I really have to focus on the design side of things? because I really wanted to create a very interesting point of view on the design side and not just on building a bigger company, getting more funding, and trying to grow it in that scale. So I obviously, the safest thing for me was reverting back because I had a very good support structure here in India. And also, there was a personal thing as well. My dad had just turned 70, and we'd gone down to his birthday and things like that. And he told me something very profound that stayed with me even till today. He told me something like, you should spend time with people when they're at their best, not at their worst, because that's where I'll remember you in that way. So that was very kind of emotionally kind of, you know, caught me off guard. And I kind of started thinking about it. You know, I was like, yeah, actually, that is exactly what I should do. I mean, I stayed away from home for so long. And now that I am a parent, I can understand that emotion as well, right, what he said. So that kind of brought me here. And I also knew that design in India was not very mature when I came back in 2015. So I kind of knew that would be a challenge to, you know, do that. And I thought, like, you know, it'd be very interesting to do it with a market such as India, which has so much of potential, right? So that is the main reasons, some of the main reasons why I came back to India. And, you know, initially a lot of my friends also didn't believe me. They were like, who leaves a job in the US and comes back? I mean, you're bluffing. Something must have happened. So I kept telling them, to some point of time, dude, there's nothing like that. I mean, I just wanted to come back because, you know, setting up a company. And I was not very familiar with, like, legal stuff in the US. And I was always afraid that, you know, something, I might miss something, right? But within India, I had a confidence that, you know what, I know some of this person here. I know a family friend who's a lawyer and who can help me and, you know, do things. So I kind of wanted to start on my own money too. Like, I didn't want to take too much of burden on myself and focus on just money, because that's the one thing that, at Analogy, that's the one thing that helped me quite a lot. Not having to do, you know, to start with, like, financial targets. Because once you have a financial target, right, it's just that. So you take every single project that comes your way because you have to pay the bills. You are paying somebody else and you have a financial obligation to which you've committed already, which, let's say it's a loan or it's some sort of funding to show that you're growing. So whether it's a branding project or a packaging project, or whether you're designing a chappal, or whether you're designing something else, right? Your point of view gets lost. So at the end of the day, you're just looking at, oh, I need to do 15 projects at, like, let's say this much cost, because I have to hit this target at the end of the year, because I have to pay back so much, right? So I didn't want to do that because I didn't want it to hit our design quality. Because then we couldn't say no to certain projects, right? So that is actually one of the biggest reasons when I was thinking about starting, that I wanted to be in a safe place. I wanted to minimize as much risk as possible because I wanted to prioritize this one at the top. So I keep telling people also a lot when I do these talks or mentoring sessions that, you know, ID is a discipline that's a marathon. It's not a sprint. You can't treat ID like, you know, I'll be super successful in 2 years or in 3 years. It's a longer game and you have to plan for it. Like, you have to plan for, like, I'll be this or I'll be this in this. And obviously during the course of the years, it'll evolve a little, even ours it evolved. It just morphed into a little bit based on the trends and so forth. But at least that core point of view, right? If you find something and you hold on to it, that'll be very good for you to build a brand, right? Which is like what I said. With studios and independent design practices, that is what I see lacking in a lot of things, is that conviction or that story of, we're doing this, right? We are known for this, or we're good for this. That is missing. I mean, you can't be everything to everybody, you know, all the time. You have to stand up for something and you have to get that, like, comfortable position of, oh, this is what I do and this is what I think I want to be. So I had a good idea about that when I started. That is one clarity I had. And I knew that, you know, connected products were going to come up and, like, the iPhone had launched. There was a lot of good in, you know, product inventions and interventions that were happening in that space. So I always knew kind of, like, this is going to go that way. And thankfully, to my experience, I got to work with a lot of these kind of technology partners. Like, we worked on one of the very first wireless charging projects, even before, you know, it came to full-fledged mainstream use. So in those projects and things like that, I had a visibility of, okay, this is what's going to come up very easily. So in that regard, I felt starting out with in a much safer position, without less risk, without obligations, without having to worry about so many operational things, and focusing on design. And I was very skeptical also, will I find the right kind of a team in it, you know, if I leave the US, will I find the right kind of people? So I wanted to focus on those things and really crack that. And that's one of the main reasons also why I moved back.
The way you're saying it, it looks like that you definitely had an idea about, you know, what was there to come. So, I mean, because of your experience, was it, did it make it easy for you to get projects, as you already had, you know, like years of experience working on very sensitive projects? So how difficult was it for you to build trust in the Indian market?
So it was a very tough. India, I feel, is still very tough for designers, because the way we are as a people, as a race, it's very different from other countries. Our risk appetite is very, very low, right? Like, so we don't mind crossing the road without looking left or right. We don't worry about getting run over. But then when it comes to design or when it comes to a project, we think of every single thing that can go wrong, right? So India as a market, from a client perspective, from a B2B perspective, was very tough. There were a lot of initial stages where we had to prove a lot of points, we had to show a lot of projects. Sometimes we even did idea pitches, just like an ad agency would do, which is very weird to me, because coming from the US, there was nothing of that sort of thing that used to happen. It still happens in India, right? Like, I mean, it's not like, people ask stuff for free. They tell you to trust them, because the bigger they are, there's more, leverage that they have asking you to do something for you, right? Like, so India as a market is very tough. I mean, even in that, but when we started working with the US market itself. So because my network was predominantly US based, I knew a lot of people in the US. My older company that I was working for was my first client, because I had their trust already. So we continued working on a lot of projects that were pending. And that's what I used to tell. I was telling a couple of people in the Mumbai talk as well, and I was doing mentoring for a couple of people online, and they were asking me, like, you know, at what point did you start, or let's say, what made you comfortable to start a studio? And one of the things I told them is the number one thing is you need to know people. If you don't have the network, don't start a studio. A lot of people think like I just go on. You're a let's say enhanced freelancer, right? You're not a studio, or you're not a design consulting business at that point. You have to have a network. Second thing is you should have at least 6 to 10 months of sustainable revenue for you to kind of do, take risks, take kind of projects that you need, right? And number three is having a trusting and a strong team with you, whether it's two people or three people. You just need to know that they're reliable. They understand your vision and your point. So for me, when I actually started in India, we didn't start on working with Indian clients. We started mainly with US clients, and then slowly we did European things. And then we started working with Indian clients very recently, almost on a larger scale. Here and there were odd projects that we did. Couple of startups. We also used to work with Amazon on some projects and things like that. So in that regard, in India, we didn't really, go to that extent. But now that we're working with clients in India, to answer your question around building trust and all, it takes a hell lot of time in India to build trust. So let's say if you're trying to work with a client, especially a bigger client, a marquee client, it takes a minimum of 6 months to 8 months to even earn their trust and for them to trust you, saying, and there's a lot of sacrifices in the journey. Like if you really look at just a profit and loss statement on your project, that account is lost. You're not going to go through it. There's a lot of investment from your side you have to make to win some of the bigger client projects and things like that. With startups, it's a lot more easier because I guess it's the more generational thing with startups. They kind of understand you on a personal level, and they kind of know the struggles that they've gone through, and they kind of relate with you on that. So they don't kind of come back and say, like, go pitch to us or do a project for us and then we'll evaluate you. All of that doesn't happen. So again, you got to really pick and choose. But then, if you're working with startups, obviously your revenue, is kind of lower in India because they have certain budgets that they don't want to go over, or their problems are not big enough to solve that, you know, you can charge a value add in terms of, right? And there are some cases when we've even told them, you don't need design to solve your problem. Honestly, like it's not a design problem, right? But it's an engineering problem or it's a manufacturing. You don't need design to solve this. So, but whereas if you're looking at bigger revenue, then yeah, you got to go after the brands that are doing products. And you know, in India, right, like there are only so many bigger brands that do products on a regular basis. So yeah, proving the trust is, it takes a very long time. It takes a very long time. You got to be patient. You got to be very, very, you know, civil about certain things. And you also got to be very cognizant of the fact that, yes, you might have already worked on it, but then the category you're working on is new. So then you got to prove again. Like you might have done, like, you know, I don't know, home appliances for quite a big thing in the US, but have you done it in India? Oh, have you done it in Bangalore? Oh no, okay, fine. Let's do one test project and then we'll see how it works. Right? So you get that a lot. You get that a lot in India. And navigating that is, I think, rather than fighting through it, I think just navigating it is a lot easier and a lot simpler. So we decided to kind of do this about 2 years ago in terms of saying, like, you know what, we'll invest in that. We'll invest in this whole long process of building trust and we'll see where it goes. Right. So we're still in the process and we'll see where it goes.
And I'm sure, I mean, at some point I'm sure you draw that line. Okay, you know, this is where I draw the line. And again, I'm sure, as you said, that a lot of times client, they don't know what they really want. So a lot of discovery, intensive discovery is also involved, right? So, I mean, it's like, what's your process like when you mention that, okay, it goes from 6 to 8 months sometimes. So is it like, you being in touch with them where they, you know, they're able to trust you? Do you think it's the cultural differences which makes that, you know, which creates that question?
Yeah, definitely. I think number one, to talk about that, yes, I think the process is to kind of constantly maintain, you know, a touch with the client to kind of understand their pain points and try to show them something very quick, right? Because what we're doing is, what happens in a discovery is you're just asking a lot of questions to which, you know, people, it's a design research problem, right? Like, so a lot of times you are asking leading questions because you want a certain type of answer. So most discovery processes fail in that regard. So you, for example, you'll say like, oh, what is your budget? Right? Like, so no client will ever give you a budget because they want to get it done at the cheapest possible. And they want to get their entire project sorted out in one shot, right? So that's a very typical client ask. You can't really blame clients for it and say, oh, you know what, that's because that's their demographic. That's how they are. Just because we are designers, we can't go and ask a client and say like, oh, you know what, hey client, my budget is 10,000 rupees and I want only maybe 2 sketches for that. Okay, how does that sound design? It's never going to happen, right? Like it's such a dreamy situation. So basically what I'm trying to say is the discovery call or the qualification process is a lot of, you know, figuring out what is the right questions to ask rather than figuring out the right answers. Because a lot of people, what they do in the discovery process is they just go after the right answers. So they look at, oh, this client answered this way. So, okay, it's an ideal client. But no, because that's because you asked a leading question, right? So our process is very much in a way where we use a lot of behavioral interviews to kind of ask some questions where, you know, we really try to dig the true intent out of the project because we really want to, this is the right project for us. It's not just the right client, it's the right project because I don't want to be working on something that, let's say, another designer can solve very easily because that's when your result starts looking the same. So a client will give you a feedback saying that what really innovative did you do? Right? It's the same thing. I could have gotten it done by this person. It's not because the result is not innovative. It's because the problem that you guys framed in such a way to a client is the same atypical one that anybody else would solve. So if you do the discovery call properly, when you qualify the client, when you qualify the problem, when you qualify the project, right, it brings out very, very good results. So we take our time with that and we kind of take our time and go through some of these processes and ask these questions, maintain constant touch with them. We go meet them. I believe in face-to-face meetings all the time. Like I never do calls as much as possible, I try to do face-to-face meetings, because then there's a lot of emotion, there's a lot of body language, right? Nowadays with email and with chat, people take things very offensively. Like you'd say like, hey, this is not possible, right? Is what you write on the email. That's your tone that you would probably have to set in the call. Hey, this is not possible. But on the email, it's like, hey, it's not possible. So there's a very different intonation that is there when you talk, on a call in front of someone. Like you can see the honesty that you have. You can see the honesty that you have. And it matters for a call. So, in such cases, we definitely do that. And it takes time. Each client is very different. Sometimes what happens is we try to validate very quickly with a result, like a visual result, to kind of gauge if they're in the right, if we are in the right ballpark of what they want. And most of the time, 90% of the time, we're right. We hit that nail pretty well. We have some baseline things of looking at, let's say, visual goals, functional goals, business goals, and then user experience goals. So we map all that out for any and every client, because that's our point of view, and that's the reason why they would have come to us. Like we've got so many projects that come in that say, by the way, guys, we want you to design a machine that makes, let's say, socks. So we really tell them easily, like, guys, we're the wrong guys. So you're coming to them. We don't design machines. We could design the socks for you if you want, but we don't design the machine, right? Because that's a very core engineering, it's not even an engineering thing. It's more like a production optimization sort of a project, right? You have very few people do it. So that is very important. And it's made a make or break sort of thing, in the way we choose clients and who we want to work with. So it takes time and the process is kind of arduous. And every year it gets refined because we find something else that a client would have done that goes back into the flow chart, gets refined and comes back with the learnings. So, I mean, there are so many times when, we've had legal calls and stuff when we're signing the agreements where we would have been like, oh shit, we should have asked these questions at the start, right? So it's not perfect. Even now, it's not perfect. It's the status is very, we have three statuses. We have like a to-do, work in progress, and a done. And for just the discovery thing, there's a status called it is what it is. Because it keeps changing all the time. So yeah, that's a very, very, very interesting thing to do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you've got to be realistic at the same time, right? So do you have the type of clients or the type list of, the type of projects you'd like to do and, so that's according to that, you reach out to them or, accept projects or do you constantly try out, okay, let's do these kind of projects? I mean, and what do you think is the right approach? Because everyone, I talk to, again, I've also at a place where I'm trying to run a business, and a lot of times people say that you got to niche it down. I mean, what do you do in that case?
So I think that advice, I would take it with a pinch of salt, because too much of niching is bad, especially in India. In the US, I agree. I agree, mature design markets where people have like a visibility or let's say an awareness of what they want to do. Yes, it makes sense. I agree with that advice of niching down. But in India, I feel like getting too niche, we're not there yet from a maturity point of view. We're not there yet. We still have maybe another 2-3 years to go in terms of when it starts getting that, right? Like, so for example, if you look at, industrial design, there's so much engineering that is expected in Indian client projects, right? There are cost targets to hit in Indian client projects, right? Because like I said, as a race, we're very risk averse. Our risk tolerance is extremely low. So, and also it's the cost of doing business in India. It's a very cost sensitive market. You can't really go and create something very new and say that, hey, we'll charge a premium for design, right? So that doesn't work overall. But in terms of, I would say, in terms of like looking at, what do you call the niche part of how you specialize, I think picking a category is much more better. That's what we did. We picked certain categories. Instead of picking a list of projects, we picked certain categories. For example, home appliances, is a category that we work a lot in. We design a lot of these home appliances. But then we always have the spin of how do you design a smart home appliance rather than just a regular one. And then we kind of pick these kind of categories and we know we're very good at it. And even in the back end, we know that we have the engineers who can work on this. We know we have designers who are experienced on this. Or I personally would have had the experience of taking something from sketch to production. Because then we understand the full facet of it. And then we jump into, you know, approaching a client for it. Like, so we wouldn't approach a client if we're not confident of what we can do. So for example, if it's audio, I've done plenty of audio in my time, you know, in my US experience and things like that. So I know the nuances of what happens around it, how engineering would react to it, what are some of the problems that will come in these projects, and where are the innovation brackets, basically. That's the biggest value for a designer or a founder. You know that, oh, there are these small pockets that nobody's picked up in, and I think I can go in and I can innovate. So that is how we select categories, and we select categories and then we select clients based on those categories. So that's when we approach somebody and say, like, hey, we're good at this. Look at our portfolio. We've got enough proof for you to kind of look at it and say that, hey, these guys are good. We should be able to, you know, do something great with them. So like you said in the first question, right, like building that trust, a part of it comes from proving that you've done these kinds of products before. Or let's say something close to that, you've done something with. I don't remember the exact quote, but there is something that I think it's from David Kelly, where he says, like, if you hire somebody who's done a chair, you'll get exactly a chair, right? So in similar ways, you know, we always tell people that also, that, you know, some of the times the best thing to happen to you if you're innovating is to hire somebody who's never done that product before. Right. Especially if it's a you know, a design project. If it's an execution project, yes, you should go hire somebody who's done it plenty of times, because then that guy can, you know, tweak it and bring it to them. But if you're discovering something new, if you're stagnating in your product line, or if you're doing the same thing every single year and you're losing customer base, you're losing a user base that you already had very strongly, your revenue is dipping down because, you know, you're only playing on cost, right? Oh, I'll reduce 20 rupees, then a customer, then another competitor, and then I'll make money this year. It's not going to happen. I mean, India's moved on from that. Like, people can afford 20 rupees. Then people can afford 100 rupees more on a regular product also. They won't care. What they will care about is what extra new things have people done it. And have these brands thought about an Indian perspective? Right? Because a lot of these innovative ideas are kind of like derivatives from Western user scenarios. Right, like you just bring them, I saw that over there, let's bring it in our product. Nobody in India ever uses it, right? Like, we have products at home where these kinds of things are there and we've never touched. We've got a juicer, wherein you put one thing in and then, like, you know, you just, the entire, it separates the fruit and seeds and then pumps out the pulp on the other side, and then you clean it and you give it to the maid, and then she's like pretty much taken the whole thing apart because it's made for easy disassembly, right? Because in the US, people clean their own appliances and utensils, right? So, but this maid of ours, she just went crazy over it. She just took every part out. I mean, you literally see the motor inside. So that's kind of an example of what I was saying in terms of product. So I don't think designing in that way where, you know, if you're just cost conscious, or if you're just, you know, like, oh, I'll reduce my bottom line and I'll give you the same product next year. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So that's why I feel like looking into categories and looking at the opportunities they present from like a future point of view of saying, maybe 2 years from now, this is what we could do. These are the opportunities compared to your competitors here. Right? So those kinds of things is what I would feel is how we select projects. And basically, this is how we see that, oh, potentially if we work with this client for 2 years, we could do this, this, and this. So we've already got an internal roadmap built. It's just up to the client whether they align with it and see that, oh, you know what, these guys have an idea of what all they could do for us. And then let us, you know, give them that opportunity to do that. That's basically the next part of discussing that and making sure that it all works.
Really amazing examples there, Asash. So, I mean, is it also depends upon the capabilities of your team, and do you think in your process you're constantly upskilling, evolving, you know, in terms of the process? But I'm sure every project demands something specific. So I'm just curious to ask this question, you know, how do you tackle this? And again, and I would also ask you, you know, to talk about how you've been building teams. Because even in our, because I think this is what I've recently learned after, you know, reading a lot, talking to a lot of people, that that your team also directly, you know, reflects your, you know, selling strategy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a very apt question also. So, because let's say, so yeah, that's kind of the kind of question that you asked about teams is very, very relevant, because the way we look at teams are, there are different levels of, you know, people that do certain kinds of things at an MG, right? Like, so we don't hire, let's say, junior designers to just do execution. For me, junior designers are basically the ones who think of the craziest sort of ideas. And when we hire, we look at portfolios just for that. We look at portfolios where, like, how ambitious are you? Are you trying to design the next Uber Sky car? Right? Yeah, then please come on board, because we want you to think that, right? Because as and when you mature and you know go through your journey, the perception is that person will innovate more, but it's not. That person knows what's wrong, where mistakes are going to happen, and that person's only going to be able to prevent it. He's not going to innovate so much. So all of us, like, even including me, right, where we can call ourselves design thinkers, you know, like, you have 4 titles on LinkedIn, right? You have TEDx, speaker, plus innovator, even I have one, futurist, all of that stuff. It's not going to help in terms of ideas, because in ideas, right, like, younger people are way, way better. So when I hire people and when I build teams, I always have this layered strategy of going from the bottom to the top. I don't go from top to bottom. So once I build that, then I know that, okay, for this project or the next project or whatever projects we do, the next level, the mid-level, is going to be a much more stability sort of a thing, which has a combination of, you know, these kinds of things, of trends and storytelling and that sort of stuff. And then the senior position is more around, you know, project management, and then figuring out how will these guys be able to, like, read a client, how will they be able to interact with a client, and that sort of stuff. So obviously they'll do the general CAD and, you know, this, and they'll be able to mentor a team and tell them that, oh, this is a shorter way to do things, and it'll improve the efficiency, right? But that's what on the operational side of design, there's a lot of things that you need to really know. And you'll know only if you run teams like this before. Because there's no other way to learn this. I mean, they don't teach this at a university. There's no papers. There's no podcast that goes through in detail about, you know, oh, how do you, you know, build a team? Like, so that's kind of what I got really good at in my career, is kind of dissecting it, figuring out, like, okay, if I have these kinds of profiles or these types of people, then they'll be able to achieve this, this, and this. Then this set will then supersede those guys, then build on what they have, and then do this. So that's basically how I look at teams, and that's how the team structured at Analogy also, which is why we're able to, you know, not have such a large team for the scale of work that we do. We keep a very minimalistic team. We don't end up doing 100 people, 150 people for what the kind of things we do. And with that also comes specialization. And to answer the second part of your question, knowing what a project needs and then kind of structuring a team for it. The way we look at it is, we look at breaking down something like a project into 3 main things. One is niche problems. One are, let's say, user problems. And then the bottom one will be, like, new opportunities and, you know, avenues. So we'll have proper people that can go into this. And usually at the top, right, like people like me or, let's say, one of the senior designers or the leads will have experience in one of these areas. So either we'll draw parallels from the industries we've worked at, or we would have actually worked on a project or a product. And we'll know that, okay, this is how we should do this. And we would have brought learnings from a lot of different diverse experiences, and we can tell them that, you know what, we should not do this, because if we do this, this is what's going to happen. So that's why I said, like, our approach is a very bottom up approach. We don't go from the top. Like, usually what happens is a lot of people say, like, I'm here, then I'll mirror my profile and I'll hire somebody here. Then I'll mirror a little bit worse clone of that person and hire at a mid-level. And then the worst one is junior will be the worst clone part of it, and I'll add on this. So a top-down approach never works. Your innovation or let's say your design quality goes for a toss. So working from the bottom up is a much better strategy. And I used to work that the same way. It's not like a lot of people think about it, but that's worked for us really well. If you look at our work, right, it's very diverse. We would have done a home appliance thing. We'll do a consumer electronics today. Then we'll do an AR map tomorrow. So that's how we can play around with all these new technology-based projects. And wherever there's a very core technology thing, we'll bring in an expert, an outside consultant who would have worked on that technology. Because you can't take chances of, I'll try and figure out some way. I'll read a couple of blogs and I'll figure this out. It never happens. So because we need to know, we need that person to know what can go wrong. Because we have to do some risk mitigation, which is, again, part of the trust building with the client. So if you don't do that, that becomes a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, you made it sound so easy, to be honest. I think so. When you're trying to make a team, so again, so you are working with a bunch of creatives. You know that we are in the business of design. So it's also a very skill oriented job, right? So how difficult is for you to pick people, you know, from their portfolio? Because again, and the next thing we're going to talk about is basically the design education in India, right? So what's the maybe issues that you've been facing in terms of, picking the right people, you know, who has maybe the right skills? So do you have that approach where, okay, you know, we're going to make like a learning course for them once they are in the team to understand more about the process?
Right now at Analogy, no, we don't have any training, but we are working on something. We are working on a couple of things, not from a training perspective, but more from a consistency perspective. Because a lot of people come with different tools, right? Like somebody will be doing SolidWorks, somebody will do Rhino, someone's doing NX. So at the end, that becomes an issue on the efficiency side of things. But if you go back to your main question of how we're looking at people, right? Like very importantly, more than looking at skills, obviously there are some core skills that I prefer. And the funny part is I don't do the interviews. So a lot of our guys know what are the type of profiles that we like, right? So when we look at people, obviously we look at a base core skills. Like for example, that shouldn't become a hindrance in your job. Like for example, if you're thinking of how I can sketch something, then you're done. Your ideas are never going to be able to go on paper, right? Or let's say if you're kind of like looking at a YouTube video and trying to create a surface in a CAD program, then yeah, you're not going to be able to get it. Or let's say, I have to figure out how lighting will work in this render environment. You're out. It's not going to work. Because we just don't have the luxury of figuring all that out. Because of a consulting environment, right? So we look at some base course. So if you have some basic lighting skills, your sense of materials are good, from a UX perspective, you're able to understand wireframing, you're able to kind of come up with user flows, you can do basic research, you can talk to users, you can kind of figure out problems on there. Sketching and like CAD, yes, then you're in, which most of the students actually have really well. But the most important thing we look at is the alignment with the team. So anybody that doesn't align, when we feel we have a lot of problems actually, so I know that's a problem, but basically we look at if you can actually become a team member here. And we look at a lot of personalities in that regard. So these are all soft skills. We look at what are your aspirations. How are you looking at how much of hunger do you have to change the status quo, for example? Do you have a passion of working on next gen projects, or are you still want to design a chair, right? Like, I mean, there are plenty, I mean, no offense to anybody listening on furniture, but, for me or for us right now, we're not interested in, let's say, designing a new chair, right? And then also, are you good at storytelling, right? Like, we'll figure that out. I mean, in the interview, when we ask you questions, it's easy to figure out whether you can tell a story. the way you present your portfolio, right? Like there are a lot of these usual scripts that come from college, which is like, I was given a brief. My junior semester assignment was this. Instead of actually talking about the problem, you start off that way, right? A lot of students do. And it's not wrong. It's just that if you had a better story to tell, oh, by the way, I was working on this, these pair of scissors. I had a lot of problems with my hands. I kind of had a pain in that. So I thought I want to solve that problem, right? Like we look for that. We look at storytelling. We look at like how, if you can create analogies, if you can create comparisons. And we look at like how sensible you are on the interview. Like if you have a, if you have an emotional quotient of being realistic, because some people, they don't know the industry, right? They'll have a contorted view of the industry saying that, it's like, you know, many Instagram reels and then, oh, this is what the design industry is. We try to read that. So to answer your initial question, yes, it's very hard to find the right kind of people. But I guess if you can call it a superpower, that is something that I've been good at. I've been very good at from a very long time is building these kinds of design teams. So it's worked out well for us. It's going to be a challenge now, especially because I think some of the team members are around 5-6 years old. So that's where it gets challenging because now you have to bring a new set of people in. You have to kind of get them up to the next level and bring all that. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. But yeah, great question though. I think it's a very good one.
So you think it's also kind of proportional to the design education we have in the country? Because, for example, I think I'm coming from a college which was kind of special in terms of what we were studying, you know. So we always used to look forward to European portfolios, you know. And we never even considered, I think maybe that wasn't a good approach. And and we always, you know, considered us moving abroad to so that we get like a proper right space. And lately also in a lot of portfolios, I've been seeing that it's, they are repeating the same mistakes again and again. Do you think it's the curriculum part or we are just like our school education, you know, it's still the same and it's very inshore-y oriented? What do you think about that?
I agree with everything you said, 100%. I feel the, so first and foremost, I feel like design is not a field where you mass produce designers, which is what is happening right now in India and in China and in, you know, other countries where they, I don't know who thought of this, you know, like every school now has a design degree. What that has created is that's created a huge gap of getting quality design educators on board, right? So you have a lot of design educators coming in with other backgrounds, right? Who are trying to apply that learning to design. So naturally what is happening is you kind of see this mass customization of people where it's bordering to commodity based work. So it's kind of like how Walmart or let's say a McDonald's does their food, right? Like, so let's say Walmart for products or like produce and then Walmart for food. You have 5 drops of ketchup, you have 3 drops of mustard and that sort of stuff, right? Like, so it's becoming like a mass production line of designers, especially in design education. So I feel that that's where the biggest gap is, where, you know, that's where you can't distinguish a portfolio from, let's say, University X to School Y. It's kind of the same thing. And then also students are, one, I feel, I was talking about this at Strat very recently when I visited them. It's like you have this atypical process of a very linear approach from day one. I'm going to start with research, then I'm going to do ideation, then I'm going to do some protos, then I'm going to do a few renders, then I'll do a few this thing, and then boom, final hero shots, 4 or 5 things. Everybody's doing the same thing. So the biggest question we're not asking ourselves is, we are going out there and we're trying to discover the user journey of every new project or every new client we're doing. But we're not discovering the user journey of ourselves as designers, which is what your portfolio is. To be honest with you, right? Like your portfolio is your reflection, your journey of where you went from semester 1 to semester 6. So what you could do very simply is if you could play that journey as a story and then you plug in your projects as and when you learn things, right? It's so much better for somebody to understand who you are as a person, who you are as a designer, what your point of view is, and what your capability and skills are. So in a way, design education needs to change in that regard. I mean, educators coming in, you can't just be looking at books and you can't just be taking theories written by people and applying it to the new generation, right? It doesn't work. I mean, there's so much information online, like YouTube's there. There are plenty of good podcasts. There are plenty of content out there where people can actually choose and become good designers. But at the same time, what I honestly believe is school is a must. I mean, 4 years in a design school can never replace your YouTube experience because you're working with people. So it gives you basic soft skills. It gives you skills of working with people, getting critiques, developing a thick skin, right? And then understanding what is the gap between different industries. What are different people doing? And basic fundamental skills, like where are you going to go get a workshop if you're sitting in your pajamas at home and trying to figure out things, especially in industrial design, right? It doesn't happen. You have to be in an academic environment. You have to learn and then you have to apply. And every single time you do a project, you get to learn to do presentation skills. You learn to refine that over a period of time. Every year you'll refine that. So that every school will give you. But as far as education is concerned, I honestly think we in India need to look at this in a very different lens. It has to be a very core collaboration between academia and industry people. And there has to be a great influx of industry people in academia. Because without that, right, without that framework, it's just going to be theory, like you said. I mean, we'll read more books. Again, we'll look at more content. And again, we'll keep repeating the same thing over and over again. And we have plenty of people, honestly, like plenty of designers in India who are extremely talented. I mean, if you look at some of the work that has been happening, and those are the guys who are moving abroad, by like you said, right? So, and then, you know, people in India are kind of stuck. And I was talking to a lot of students in the Mumbai Design Express event where, you know, they were asking similar questions. They were like, so what do you think we should do? What do you think we should do in this regard? And my thing is like, okay, fine, we've got design education, which is this thing. But then you guys have access to Behance, you guys have access to YouTube. You got to have a a comparison. You set a benchmark, you look at a portfolio, set a benchmark, and then you do an awareness of, okay, this is where I am. So this is what I have to bridge. So you can't just trust the school to keep giving you interesting projects. Like I see every single project come up with like a laptop stand. Or let's say some sort of a lamp, or there is like a very atypical problem that has to be solved. So then how are you going to even distinguish that this person is better than this person? And most of it is group projects, right? So like you never know within the group project who's done what. It all looks nice at the end because you have like, it's like cinema. It's you've got 8 takes on your portfolio. You can go refine it whenever you want and present something beautiful. But in real world things, you get only 1 take. You've lost a client by the end of it if it is not. So I think there has to be an effort from, let's say there has to be an awareness to the student community also that these are things that you can do on your own, right? Build an ambitious project on your own. I mean, you don't have to wait for the school to give you a brief. But on the other hand, also design education needs to change in a big way. I mean, we can't keep applying the same age-old design principle textbook. You know, those weird ones with just the lines and circles and flowchart graphs. You can't apply that to just design education. Again, design is all about people. It's not just about applying a theory to here and here. And just as a disclaimer, that's the reason why we don't have a rigid process and analogy. We use larger frameworks to work. Because if you start doing process, right, you're mass producing the same thing over and over again. Why do you think there's a process? Process comes from where? It comes from manufacturing because they wanted to standardize them. So, in that regard, I mean, there's a lot of process improvement that happens. It's a career, systems design, system thinking. There's a lot of work that happens there. But again, at the end of it, when you give a designer something, right, if he's just going from step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4, step 5, which is what a student also does, that is not going to work. So I understand that, you know, school builds core fundamental skills. And then a student has to, you know, go one level above, kind of figure out what is happening around the industry and then augment on it and improve upon it. But I feel like, I think it's a very simple case of awareness on the process side, or let's say on the project side also, where your guidance given can actually change things. Like, you know, like there has to be something more interesting feedback. Like we could say something like, okay, why are you designing a scissors with just, you're going to use with the same kind of things. Can you design finger, you know, scissors with, just used with the thumb, right? That'll change the whole interpretation of how the object looks. And for a student, that's so exciting. Instead of doing this, if you were doing this with your thumb and it's cutting everywhere, right? That is such an interesting way to look at an object. That's a fresh approach. So what we should be looking at design education is, again, asking the right kind of questions, motivating people to think differently, not just apply whatever's in there onto a project and then just move on from there. That's why portfolios are the same. I mean, like right now we're hiring, so we see so many of these portfolios. And they're all the same. Like you said, you know, there's one start project, like, okay, so, and then most of it is very atypical. You have that thumbnail page where they show like six different thumbnails. So you can kind of tell, okay, so this is exactly like the portfolio. So before it used to be like 15, 20 seconds. Now it's dropped down to 6 to 8 seconds of qualification. Oh, this is the same chair, tape dispenser, one UX app, and then a couple of sketches and camera photos. Like so portfolio done. So it can't be that. Like what I always tell people also, like, you know, it's not quantity. Like you need to, you could show three projects, but show, you know, show prototyping, show handmade prototypes, you know, not the final prototype. Show mistakes in the portfolio, because that is what, that is the superpower of a designer, is making mistakes, because that's not mistakes, that's iterations. And then, you know, showing that how did you fix those things is such a good process. But we as designers, we do the same thing. I mean, we've been trying to redo our website to show the iterations, wherein we've done so much work, so much of things that, where we could actually show on it, right? Like, so that's what gives clients a trust that, oh shit, okay, these guys are going to fail, but they're going to fix it. Same thing for a potential employee. Oh, this guy's failed so many times. I'm pretty sure he knows all the mistakes that he's made, right? We don't show that either. We show these perfect results, right? Like, oh, great renders. You know, great things. Some of them don't even show that. They'll I think somebody just used the marquee tool or the magic brush tool in Photoshop, and he just forgot to cut out the white, you know, leftover things, and he's put it on a black background. Like, it was like 101 on contrast, like theory on contrast. That's perfect. Like, it's highlighting every mistake that is in that sketch. Boom, it's coming out. So yeah, that's a very different way. But I feel more than just the education, I think the perspective of design education needs to change. There are a lot of very good people in India that are doing some really interesting work in design education. But I just think that they're all very scattered right now. And I feel that those efforts need to come together somewhere. I don't know how it's going to happen. But I think a different perspective is needed for design education, rather than, you know, let's say maybe a curriculum. And I feel a curriculum for design is kind of limiting. I feel curriculum should be there for foundation courses, but not really the entire design education. So, but anyways, that's just my opinion. Let's see how it will evolve.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely tells your experience about looking at so many of the portfolios. I'm sure, you know, more students who are building their portfolio should listen to this podcast, I'm sure. Do you think this is the reason that you mentor people, you go to college and, you know, speak about it? Because I think when we got in our college the first time, you were teaching at NID, and instantly you mentioned about the, you know, the need of being in the college and really tell them about what's happening in the industry. And definitely you were very energetic about it. So yeah, I mean, do you think that's something that you always wanted to do and you just started doing it?
No, I felt a very big need to kind of start doing it at the academic level, because I honestly felt, looking at some of the work that's coming in and also where we were headed, right? Like I'm a big believer in the power of, power of India and what we are doing as a country. There's so many talented people in India, right? Like, it's just very hard for me to believe. It's kind of like the concept of, you know, floating a football team to go play internationally, right? Like 1.4 billion people. You can't put a team of like, you know, 10, 12 people together to go play at the international stage. It's the same kind of thing with design. Like I always felt like there's so much potential. There's so much talent. I hear some of the ideas that come out of certain, like, you know, colleges and students, when I have interactions with them, and I'm like, this is great. Like, then why can't I see it on your portfolio? Like, why don't I see it in this? Right. So that's kind of when I decided that, yes, I think I should take a little bit of an active role in academia, where, you know, I can at least see, in my experience, I had the fortunate, of meeting some very interesting people and learning from them. So in that way, I kind of wanted to give it back, saying that, you know, mentors and, you know, industry people who kind of like helped me kind of get from point A to point B, they were very, very crucial in my growth. And that was a big compounding growth also. It was not just incremental. So I wanted to do the same thing also for as many people as I can, realistically, while running a studio. So that's kind of one of the reasons why I agreed to go to NID and, mentor a course over there. I'm also talking to a few other academic institutions and universities around, trying to help them as realistically as possible right now. I just joined ADP List as a mentor in industrial design. So, and I think I'm just doing Saturdays one half. I know I was surprised ADP List has like Mondays to Saturdays to Sundays. But I think in my current capacity, I can do a little bit of that. I even volunteered at my alma mater at NC State to kind of mentor a few students there. And so in my capacity, I feel that's one thing that I wanted to do in terms of giving back to the design community, and also to kind of encourage and motivate people. Also. Like, I feel like a lot of students are kind of dejected in the fact that, you know, they had these expectations as a designer, but then once they graduated out, they kind of have this, you know, oh my God, did I do the right thing? Like, I had so many questions, people asking, like, should I have chosen another profession? Right. So.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is ridiculous, because, like, you can't think that way. I mean, you've done 4 years right now, and you know, you can't go back. You just need to think forward and look at where you're going to go. So, yeah, that's one of the main reasons why I decided to start doing it.
Yeah, ADP is a great platform for sure. I mean, I think I've learned from a lot of people on that platform. You also mentioned that you always want the main idea, you know, you always wanted to keep like a small team, you know, and keep the quality. So, and at the same time, how do you think that expand when you're trying to expand? How are you trying to keep up the quality? You know, so how do you keeping that balance? Because again, it's also, you should be very organized, I think, in order to have like a small team. Everyone should know their task and what they're bringing to the table. So how are you fixing that problem? Because I think you are expanding already in Singapore or somewhere, and then you had plans to, I mean, congrats for that. I would love to know about that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's a very apt question. So, in my experiences, though, like, I've always worked in very, very small core teams, right? So, the level of specialization and the level of confidence and independence is very high with these kinds of teams. So, when we hire, one is we look for people like that, who are pretty independent, who have their core skills very, very sorted out and things like that. And so, what it leaves to us is exactly what you said. We are supremely organized. I mean, if you're ever at the studio, I'll show you how we go through things. We have a very strong project management system. So every single project is mapped out, broken down into tasks, into subtasks, who's doing what their capabilities are, strengths are, and then it's assigned to them. And then there are project managers for every single project who look through and kind of manage that, and say that, okay, this is happening and so on. So we have weekly reports, we have quarterly reports, we have monthly reports to kind of ascertain where a project is going forward. So we go into huge detail into a project. So we know even at one point what we would have budgeted for a client in terms of hours, and we've gone above that also, because at that point you're basically losing money, right, on a project. So we go to a very, very minute detail of how to plan projects. And that's the only way you can run a small team. You can't really, because every time you feel the need for doing something extra, let's say the client puts in an extra project, then the immediate reaction is, oh, I need to hire. But that's not so, because let's say that you could actually have another resource, if you planned it properly, you could have another resource already sitting there who could actually take that over. It's just a matter of you figuring out how to schedule it and then how to work through it. And what this also does is having a smaller team means having a cumulative experience that is better than a larger team, right? You see stats on websites saying, 100 years of cumulative experience. But that's just a vanity metric because you can't have 100 plus years of experience. But in a smaller team, right, like even the 20 years of experience that you can accumulate together will be the relevant experience. So that's why I believe smaller teams are very, very important. My philosophy from day one has always been like, we want to be like the special forces in the army. We don't want to be the army, or we don't want to be the police force, right? We want to be very specialized, have a very wide horizontal set of skills and a core set of vertical skills. And that's across every person. So for example, if you look at how a special forces team is made, you'll have a sniper, you'll have a scout, then you'll have a heavy weapons expert, then you'll have like maybe 2-3 light machine gunners, and then you'll have maybe one guy who plans the exit, and there's the team leader, and sort of things like that. So similar ways, we've kind of modeled the team on a similar sort of a platform, like saying that, but if you look at that special forces team, if they need to switch, then obviously they'll do all of that. They might not do it at 100% level, but they'll do it easily at 60-70%, right? So that's in a similar way how analogy is structured. We look for that kind of thing. We know that, okay, in ideation, these guys are really good. Okay, in visualization, this is really, really good. But then this guy in visualization is at 100, or this guy in visualization guy for ideation is probably at 50 or 60%. So we look at that sort of skill set before we even build a team. And then we can switch around. And as and when people start working, right, they'll be surprised to learn that the visualization guy is actually really good at ideation also. He's never actually explored it, or he never had that kind of a mentorship to kind of go. And so that's how it generally works. But we organize that very well. We have a very strong project management system, goes from the start, from the discovery, all the way to project planning to design planning, process, then execution. So, and that's the reason why I told you, right? We keep the process very simple. We don't do process, we do frameworks. Because then we can model a project very customized to a client. We don't have to go on a very same linear process. Because then after that, your work as a studio starts stagnating. Your work will be the same thing because the results will be the same because you're following the same process, same steps, right? So, with smaller teams, it's a blessing in disguise. You can keep your overheads low, your trust with people are better, you know them on a first-hand basis. You know them more as people than team members, right? So the camaraderie that you build along with your team members is something that people will cherish. And that also will bring down your attrition rate because you're not looking at a transactional relationship in a team, but more on a symbiotic relationship.
Yep. You have a pretty clear idea about how you're, making the most out of your team. And when we talk about expanding to different country, altogether, I'm sure there are cultural differences and the kind of, I don't know. I mean, I'm just guessing that maybe the same, the same thing you're doing for Indian team, maybe it won't work there. So I'm sure I do have like mentors who are helping you or you have like a process that you keep in mind not to expand, because I'm sure there's also a lot of funding important in this. It's it's very sensitive.
Yeah, there's a lot of lot of factors that come when you're expanding globally. Like you rightfully said, funding is very, very different. So generally, the way we do things with global expansion is some of us team members will pretty much take a whole year to kind of ascertain the market there. We make regular trips down there. We kind of try and talk to other people in there, understand the market, understand whether there's a need for somebody like us to even come. We don't just go in and say like tomorrow, oh, Singapore, okay, we'll go there. We make a very clear business case out of it and say that, okay, you know what, there is an opportunity for us to do this amount of business there. And this is the impact that we'll have in this region. If the answer is a yes on the checklist for everything, only then we go there. And team structures are all different in each region because, like you said, more mature markets will require a different type of a team structure. But then we break up we have been very clear in terms of figuring out what is required for that market, and that will be based locally, and the rest actually gets run out of the India studio in that regard. So we don't want to make the same mistakes that big studios have done in emerging markets, which is, again, in my experience, I've seen all that, where a lot of big studios have just taken the atypical approach of, oh, this is a US studio, I'm going to create a clone of that here in India. It's never going to. It's always going to falter, which is why I'm sure there are plenty of big names in India here in studios. And it's not the, it's kind of like a shadow of the original entity. Right? So, and that's because you're not taking a local first approach. You have to take a local first. You can't just take, we are this branding deck. Okay, studio here. That's not going to work. So yeah, like you said, there is a lot of research that goes on into a region. So let's say after Singapore, we're now planning either the US or Europe. So we end up doing a lot of research, on ground research. We talk to a lot of people there. There'll be a lot of people that I reach out to on LinkedIn, like founders, other studio owners, and so on and so forth. And yeah, I definitely collect a lot of information, because like you said, some of these decisions are very big and very expensive also, right? So it needs to make sense from a business point of view before you even jump in. I mean, it's great to say, tell you that, you know, hey, we have an operation in Singapore, but maintaining it on a daily basis is a big, big pain. So yeah, that has to happen. Due diligence has to happen.
And why did you even feel a need of starting a studio in Singapore, to be specific, because of the amount of clients you had or something? Just curious to know.
No. I mean, see, like at some point of time, we always, one is as a business, we always need to look at how do we scale, right? And with consulting, right? Like there's, this is what I feel. I know there are a lot more successful people than me who've grown businesses to 200, 300 crores, and you know, in consulting consulting work and B2B work. But at least in the area that I am, especially in industrial design and combining industrial design with digital design, I feel there's a certain cap at which in a region you'll kind of stop. Whether it is based on the number of people you have, whether it's the attrition of the team, or whether it's the attrition of clients themselves, I feel you hit a cap at some point in the region, right? Both from a financial point of view and both from a project satisfaction point. But when we go to new markets, right, we always end up learning something new, which we can come back and implement in India. So let's say in Singapore, we're working on some very interesting new XR and AR kind of projects, which I think in India will come in 3 or 4 years down the line. So we will be the first people to kind of go and work on those kinds of projects, because we would have had the experience of working on it in Singapore, right? So that forward vision has to be there in terms of saying that, some of these markets are doing something interesting and new, and I want to be there. I want to be on the ground, learning it, figuring it out. But at the same time, you can't do it as an investment, right? Because we are completely bootstrapped. We don't have any external funding. We don't have any of that. So you have to really, really, you know, figure out where are you going to put your money. And the only thing you could do is by working on client projects, getting that revenue, but at the same time, learning these kinds of things. So that's the main reason why, you know, global work is important. Because at some point of time, some of these will replicate in other regions, or they'll come as different trends, or they'll come as offshoots of that trend. And if you understand that trend from day one, you could be the first person to work on some of these projects. And we always want to be the first to work on some new exponential technology that's coming in or doing something in that regard. So, at least that's the aspiration. We're not the first. I'm just, you know, that's the aspiration where I want to be. So, but being in these regions gives you that visibility. It gives you the exposure to such sort of projects, which is mainly
right. Yeah. Makes total sense. I think now this one's a little worth the question. I mean, definitely whatever you're doing takes a lot from you. I'm sure, you know, managing the teams, building, expanding, and also, you know, creating good work, getting good work. How do you manage all that? And I think you've also mentioned that you know, you have like a pretty good routine. You get up at 5 a.m. and do you think this has instantly have changed the way you work? Something, because again, a lot of people you know, talk about getting up at 5, you know, have like a tight routine. So do you have like a routine like that? Okay, from this time to this time, I'm going to do a specific task, or your calendar is booked most of the time, things like that.
Well, I discovered the routine thing about a couple of years ago, especially during the COVID times, because I was trying to, you know, kind of divide my time between family and work, because, you know, working from home, how it can be, right? You start at 6 in the morning, you could work till midnight and you'll continue working, right? So I really wanted to kind of put kind of a stop to certain things. And my personality, ever since I started as an entrepreneur, has there's no distinction between personal time and work. It's Saturday. Sunday is the same as Monday for me, right? So I really wanted, especially after my daughter was born, I kind of realized that I can't do that. I can't keep doing this. It's not a sustainable thing. So that's the main reason why I got a routine. But it's been very good for me. I mean, I feel I get a lot more done in a day than what I used to do before. So what I used to do before was, as and when things came on, it was kind of like a dopamine hit, right? And if I didn't have anything to do, I'd kind of be fidgety. I'd always be like, oh, I have to do this. I'd go bother some team members. Hey, what are you doing? What are you doing? I mean, I kind of felt good. Like, oh, what am I? I'm asking people. I'm kind of being a full leader and all that. But I was just wasting their time, to be honest, at one regard, right? So with the routine, I know, like, okay. And then I have a chunk of my time in the morning to myself. Like, I don't check emails or any messages until 8:30, until I get done with my morning routine. Like, I'll go for a walk, or I'll have some sort of a meditative thing to do, do some yoga, things like that. And then, you know, take some time to kind of read, or maybe just think. Reflection for me is a huge thing. Like I told you, like, I have an app where I constantly keep writing shit down. And for me, like, those are the ideas that come in the morning when it's very quiet. So for me, waking up early has been a very good habit. Thankfully, again, as you get older, you kind of wake up early, which is also great, right? So I started doing that. And then when I get to work, I have some very clear things. So in the morning, I check. We have something called a my task overview of everybody's task of what they're doing. So I just check that on a very high-level basis to see if the priorities are right. And then I have times clearly branched out for my work. And then so I can leave on time. I can get home to my daughter on time. I can spend time in the evening, read her a book in the evening, or go out to the park, or do something in that regard. So I feel routines are very important. And I've been trying to get our, at least our mid-level and senior-level guys here to start getting into a routine also. Because what I realized was at work, if you have a routine, right, there'll be overlapping areas. For example, if you're working on a strategy thing, what happens is one guy is working on a process document. He finishes at 7 p.m. and then puts it out to review when everybody else has probably gone home for the day. If he had done it at 11 a.m. in the morning, that task would have gotten done that day itself. But then you've just wasted one more day because your routines are not synced, right? So we've been trying that now to kind of get that improvement in at least the you know, senior management positions, where let's say finance and PD and marketing kind of have similar routines where they can overlap on these kinds of things and kind of work on things faster. For example, social media. I mean, we are so bad at social media, right? Like, so it's like you post whenever you want. If we had these kinds of routines, then, you know, that would actually streamline a lot better. So I feel routines are very important. I feel like if you just, my only suggestion would be is, if you make a list of things that you do every day for a week, you journal all the things that you do every day for a week, right? And then I did it on Figma. I just noted down everything. And then I just started figuring out patterns of repeatable things that I do. And then that made it very easy to make it into a routine. And I used to look at times where I did it. So we have a timesheet culture at Analogy. Everybody submits timesheet. I do as well. And we look at those to kind of figure out patterns of what are repeatable. And once we figure out, okay, this is where you're doing this, this, and this, like 11 o'clock, and then one day at 11:30, another day at 10:30, then actually you should be breaking up from 10:30 to 11:30 as that task. Right? So, routines, I feel, is very important for a team to work together also, not just your individuals.
Right, you must have it. I mean, I'm definitely pumped to, you know, kick off my routine, and I think I've been in the process that I'm slowly getting better. But yeah, Vyasa, I mean, thanks a lot for, you know, for this conversation. There was so much to learn. I'm sure, I mean, our listeners also gonna learn a lot from this. And thanks again for hopping onto the podcast.
Absolutely, man. I mean, it was my pleasure. I felt amazing chatting with you. I know we've chatted before a little bit. Let's continue the conversations. And, again, thanks for having me here. It was really good. I mean, I don't know how we spent close to almost an hour and a half, which just went in the blink of an eye. So, more power to you. I don't know how you're managing a podcast and a business. So, more power to you again on that. Great work. Keep on doing it. Again, like I said, everybody as founders, we need to push Design in India before Make in India happen. So, let's do more of Design in India. Yep.
Cheers for that, Vyasa. I see you in Bangalore, hopefully.
Absolutely, man. You're more than welcome. Come down to the studio. We can sit and have a chat in person also.